Proverbs. We're going to Ecclesiastes 11. Did you know that there were Proverbs in Ecclesiastes? Who knew? Ecclesiastes 11. Have we done this one yet? You don't know? Go to Proverbs and then keep going to your right. It's the next book after Proverbs. If you hit Isaiah, you have gone too far. Number 11. Okay. We were doing a devotional with our kids the other day, the day before yesterday, and this concept came up, and I think it's a good one for all of us, especially in light of most of your life stages, and if you're not there yet, you will be soon, where this proverb will, or this Ecclesiastes, what's the singular of Ecclesiastes, will be applicable to you. So we'll look at 11, 1 through 6, so it's a long one, but there's a great lesson in the midst of this, all right? 11:1, cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you will not find it after many days. Okay, so we're talking here about, obviously, Israel, an agrarian culture. This is Solomon, and he's talking about now sending away what you have grown, okay, your bread on the waters, your wheat, whatever harvest you have, put it on a boat, send it away, okay, see what happens. Divide your portion to 7 or 8, okay, in verse 2, for you do not know what misfortune may occur in the earth, okay. If clouds, verse 3, are full, they pour out rain upon the earth, and whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, wherever it falls, wherever the tree falls, there it lies, okay? The idea of what Solomon's talking about here is, man, take what you have and give it away, okay? 11:1, your harvest, what would you normally do with that which you have spent all year preparing? You've sowed the field, now you're at the stage where you've reaped it and you've brought it in. What would be the tendency in this culture? What would you do with it? You store it and do what with it? Eat it, right? Because that's your food. That's your life. What is Solomon saying to do with it? Send it away, okay? Not just like give it away. He's proposing something, okay? But he's not saying, verse 2, be haphazard about it. Don't be crazy. Divide your portion 7 or 8 ways, right? Don't in the 90s invest in internet stock and put all your money in retirement in internet stock. And then when the bottom falls out of the market and it all goes south, you haven't diversified. He's saying, be wise, okay? Take your portion, divide it amongst 7 or 8 ships, okay? Send it out to different places because you don't know ultimately what's going to happen. You don't know what misfortune may occur on the earth. You're not in control. God's in control. So be smart about how you divide up your fortune, if you will, or your things, okay? Because, verse 3, if the clouds are full, they pour rain on the earth. Is that right? Is that a blessing to a farmer? Full clouds, full of rain? Absolutely, right? You need water, okay? So that's a great thing, okay? So if that happens, you don't know, you're not in control, but see what happens. And whether a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, wherever that tree falls, there it lies, okay? If a tree falls in your property, other than damaging your fence, what do you have now? You got firewood. That's a great thing. Cut it up. Keep your house warm all winter. You don't know if it's going to fall to the south or to the north. It's not up to you. So diversify, be smart, give it away, and trust God, okay? Verse 6, or verse 4, rather. Keep going there. What does that mean? He who watches the winds will not sow. He who looks at the clouds will not reap. Not daydreaming so much. Waiting. Waiting for what? The perfect opportunity. When the wind is like this and all the things in my life line up just so, then I'll step out in faith. Then I'll take a risk. If I have everything figured out and calculated and can put it on an Excel spreadsheet and everything in my life is the way it's supposed to be, then I will step out in faith. He says, man, he who watches the wind for it to blow in the right direction, you're never going to sow your field, okay? And he who looks at the clouds, you're never going to reap. You're never going to find the rain. You've got to take risks. Verse 5. Keep going.
As you do not know the way, the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything.
You don't have any idea how the mind and the heart of God work, okay? Just like you don't know how a baby is formed in the womb of a woman. That's crazy to presume on God and think that you could figure all these things out. Trust God and know that He's in control. Verse 6. Sow your seed in the morning, meaning scatter it, throw it out, do your job, and do not be idle in evening, meaning work. Don't pray for a hole while you're leaning on a shovel, okay? Do what you need to do to see if the will of God can be accomplished in your life, but you've got to risk. For you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good, okay? The idea of this proverb is risk. Put your life out there. Go do something nuts. Be crazy, but be responsible, right? Divide your portion between 7 or 8, okay? And think through what God wants you to do. But don't wait for the perfect opportunity to line up before you ever say, Lord, I'm all in. I'm putting all my chips in the middle of the table. Whatever you want from me, I'll do it, okay? There are seasons in life where God's going to call you to do crazy, nutso things, okay? Respond to that. It may not make sense. Take calculated risks. Ask for counsel. Make sure it lines up, okay? Don't run out there like a chicken with your head cut off. But there'll be seasons where God calls you to do that. And those are some of the most enjoyable, fun, life-giving, crazy, scary seasons that you'll ever experience in your life, right? Some of you are here in this room because of that, right? You uprooted and moved and said, man, I'm going to go through some residency program and an internship, and I'm going to go to Israel or whatever it may be, and that's how you wound up in these seats. Some of you, man, you're thinking about future ministry opportunities and where God may call you. Let this kind of be a guide to you, all right? It's a wonderful set of advice from a guy who had everything he could have possibly wanted and said, risk it all, throw it all away for whatever God would have you to do, all right? So there is something very biblical about risk and just saying, Lord, I'm setting it out there for you. What is God calling you to do as an individual? What has he asked of you? Do you know your gifts? Do you know your talents? Do you know your history? Do you know the things that set your heart ablaze, right? And for every one of us, that's different. And if you do, don't wait until every opportunity lines itself up perfectly to go do it. Go do it, okay? Don't look up in 7 years at your tombstone and go, man, I can't believe I spent my life doing that. I wish I would have done something else. I was reading the other day, a friend of mine who's not a believer but has some very interesting insights into life. He posted a deal from basically like a home hospice nurse. Her job was to take care of people in the last like days, weeks, months of their life, right? And she'd done this for years, and she published a book called a paper that turned into a book, like the biggest regrets of a person's life. So she would ask these people, what do you wish you would have done differently? And they were all kind of over the map. There was a theme of 5. And then for a male, she said to a person, every male said the exact same thing, okay? One of their number one things that 100% of males surveyed said, they said, I wish I wouldn't have spent as much time with my career. I wish I wouldn't have spent as much time trying to climb a corporate ladder. And I wish I would have done the things that I really wanted to do. 100% of males at the end of their life said that. Right? That's crazy. Do that now. You guys are young. God has great plans for you. Think about what that is. And when those things come, go do them. Okay? Don't be irresponsible. Don't be nuts. But don't be afraid to risk. Okay? It may not all add up on the bottom line, but God may be calling you to do it anyway. All right? So be encouraged. God likes that. And we'll call you to that at some point in your life if he hasn't already, okay? There will be a leave-er moment and go to Canaan, and it doesn't make any sense, but you get to go anyway, okay? So, thoughts, questions, musings. Nada? All right. Exodus. For those of you guys that, two things. Number one, Jordan, his grandmother had, make sure I get this right, Jared, surgery yesterday, had some complications. She knows the Lord, and it sounds like it's a good situation other than the fact that they didn't expect the complications. So as we pray this morning, somebody be mindful of that and just pray for him and their family and her and ask that God would be gracious in the midst of that. Let's pray for that, and then I'll mention the other piece here in a second. So Jared, in fact, will you pray for us? And for Jordan,
Father, this morning as we come to study your word, Lord, and learn more about you, we want to take a moment and lift up Jordan's family. Lord, we don't know the full scope of what's going on. going on with his grandma, Lord, but we know it's a tough situation for them, and we want to lift them up. Lord, if it's in your will to extend your hand of healing and comfort to them. Lord, we don't always understand why some things that seem simple and seem that they should just go smoothly don't. Lord, we pray for that family. We want to lift them up to you.
God, thanks for our time. We appreciate an opportunity to study your word and for it to guide and move us and direct our paths. And pray, God, as we continue to look at the life of Moses and your shaping of him and how you're going to use him in these next years and moments in his life to direct Israel and to guide a disobedient and obstinate people through the wilderness. God, would you teach us, would you help us not to be the Israelites of old, but the Israelites of the new generation that trust you, that look to you, that though they have issues, ultimately, God, or have hearts that are malleable and soft and willing to be shaped by you. So, God, teach us this morning, we pray. In Christ's name, amen. Thanks, church. All right, so we started walking through now that Israel is out of the crossing of the Red Sea. We have left Egypt. We saw now immediate difficulties in their life. Okay, and I talked about four that are leading basically to a midlife crisis for Moses in chapter 18. Okay, four that started in chapter 15. You guys remember the first issue that they hit?
Water.
Okay, 15:22. We saw that there was no water to drink. They're 3 days out into the wilderness. They grumble about the bitter water at Marah. Okay, God has Moses throw, is this one the tree? Yep. Throws a tree into waters and it becomes sweet to drink. Okay, so that was the first issue, no water to drink. Second one is right on the heels of that, chapter 16. What was the issue there? There's nothing to eat, right? We're hungry, okay? They've been a month in the wilderness now. They're hungry, and what does God provide for them? Manna, right? So nothing spectacular in terms of, like it wasn't a filet and bacon wrapped and, you know, all these kinds of wonders, but it was, I got really hungry. That sounds so good. Wow, sorry. Sorry. But that's what God provided. Let's all go to Huckleberry's. So he takes care of them, and that's going to be their diet for the next 40 years as they wander through the wilderness. They get to eat, you know, manna. So simple, cracker-like, wafer substances, some type of sweet taste to it, but that's how God provides. Every day, you gather double on the Sabbath, and every morning you roll out your tent with your Folgers, and you grab your morning breakfast. That sustains you for the day, and that's how they live for 40 years, okay? So God provides in a miraculous way. So water, food, and then what was the next one again? 17?
Water
again, right? So again, God is hitting them at their very basic needs, right? These are things that if you don't have them, you're going to die. Food, water, shelter. And God is obviously sheltering them. They have this mobile, you know, camp basically that they have set up that we'll learn more about in the book of Numbers, but he's taking them down to their very basic of needs, okay? And then the last issue we hit was 17, chapter 8. What was the last deal? You guys remember? They're being attacked by who? The Amalekites, and they are filthy, McNasty people, I think was my exact description of them, okay? Why are they so awful? What did they do to Israel? Attack the rear, which was who? No, women and children, okay? So they are awful, okay? So God is going to ask them ultimately to be wiped off of the face of the earth, okay? That will come from the hand of Saul later on, okay? So we'll see that later, okay? So just big picture, I want you to think about emotional state of Moses right now. We saw him very clearly say, listen, God, any more and these people are going to stone me. Like they are hacked at me because they can't eat, they can't drink, they're upset. And he feels a stress in his life that ultimately now, chapter 18, he's going to get resolved, okay? So he's going to meet now an old friend, father-in-law Jethro, who's going to steer him in the right direction. So let's pick up in 18:1, and let's watch now the climax of this emotional breakdown for Moses.
Father-in-law heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel's people. The Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt.
So he's heard this story, which is cool. And we're going to see this as a theme that the people around this land all hear about the great works of God. Okay, so at some point, Zipporah and Moses' two sons had gone back to go live with Jethro during this season. Okay, so they've been gone. I think we're at like 3 months right now. And you see in verse 7, Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and bowed down and kissed him. And they asked each other the welfare and what went in, and then went into the tent. Verse 5, Moses' father-in-law came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness. So he brings now Zipporah and his two kids out to meet him. Okay, so they're in really, really close to Midian, which is Jethro's stomping grounds. This is where Moses grew up. So they're now far out into the wilderness where we had kind of looked at originally. So we're at basically in Saudi Arabia today, modern day Saudi Arabia. All right. So they meet, they talk about this. And I want you to notice, this is how Moses responds to Jethro. This is what he tells him. Keep reading there in 8.
And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how the Lord had delivered them.
So given Moses' emotional state, what do you notice about 8? What do you like about that? How has his journey been thus far, Moses's?
It's been pretty rough.
It's been pretty rough, right? But what does he say to Jethro? How does he paint this? Man, let me tell you what my God has done. Yes, it's been difficult, but God parted the Red Sea. He's provided water. He's provided food. This has been amazing, okay? So Jethro obviously is a Midianite, is not a he's not a follower of Yahweh by nature or by history. So he's learning about God through Moses, right? Moses has every opportunity to be like, oh, it's been awful, and my God did this, and it's horrible. But he paints for him an awesome picture of God, even in the midst of difficulty. So I like that about Moses. And I think part of why I think Jethro is a believer is because of the influence of Moses and his perspective and his the way he communicates about what his God has done, okay? And Jethro's heard signs of this before even Moses shows up, right? So he knows, man, I let you go back to Egypt to go deal with these issues, and now I'm already hearing stories about what God's done. So pretty cool, okay? Verse 9, keep going.
And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that the Lord had done in Israel, and that he had delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians.
Okay, and here's maybe the turning point in his life. Keep going. So that may have been a statement right there of, man, now I know your God is legit. Like, I have seen him move, and I've heard you talk about him, okay? Verse 12, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. Aaron came with the elders of Israel to eat the meal with Moses, with Jethro there and before God, okay? So they literally make a sacrifice to God, thankfulness in terms of what he has done, and now they celebrate that together, okay? Now, next day, things are about to change. So now Jethro, the older, wiser father-in-law, okay, this is really, in a sense, again, Moses' father figure. He's watching now how Moses leads his people, okay? 13, read this.
The next day, Moses sat and judged the people, and the people stood around Moses from morning till evening.
What does that mean, that Moses sat around and judged the people from morning to evening? What is he doing? Conflict resolution 101, right? He's dealing with all the gripes and the complaints for 1 million, 2 million people. Like, we got a ton of people that are coming to Moses saying, hey, well, we were traveling, you know, I loaned so-and-so this, and they dropped it and broke it, and now I don't have my Calphalon pan anymore, and, you know, my Nalgene got busted because so-and-so, right, they left it back at the, you know, at Mara. What do we do? Okay, so Moses is hearing these things how long? All day. So literally, he's sitting in a chair. Next. Okay, you owe him 2 Nalgenes. Next. Okay, you, right? So he's working with the people. Why are they coming to Moses? He's a leader, okay? They obviously respect him, okay? God's appointed him as leader, and he's got good advice, right? What's the problem with the situation? the ratios are not real good, right? That's not good leadership. Notice what Jethro says, verse 14. So he's questioning, he's pushing, why do you do this? Why are you doing it by yourself, Moses? Okay. And he says, well, hey, this verse 15, people come because they want to know about what God thinks, and that's why they come to me. Verse 16, when they have a dispute, it comes to me. I judge between a man and his neighbor and make known the statutes of God and his laws. Well, if God's put me in this position, that's my job. I'm just doing what God asked me to do. Okay. It sounds very noble. Jethro sees it very differently. Verse 17. Doesn't that sound odd? Like, you're judging between the people, you're solving disputes, you're doing conflict resolution. We all value that. Jethro says, this is a bad deal. This is not good. And here's why. And underline 18, okay? He gives him two reasons why he says, this is a really bad idea.
You and the people with you will certainly wear yourselves out, for the thing is too heavy for you.
What are the two reasons he gives? Mine means a little bit differently. You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you. For the task is too heavy for you. You cannot do it alone. Long-term results of this is what? You're going to burn out. You're going to flame out. And you're going to kill the people in the process. They're going to burn out. They're going to become frustrated because they've got a lot. It's like the DMV, right? Like how long is that line trying to get to Moses to get his insight? It's ridiculous. So he says, this is not good. Your intentions are great, but the way you're executing this plan, Moses, is not good. You're going to kill the people and yourself in the process, right? Is this a good ministry lesson here? You guys ever seen a pastor flame out? It's ugly, okay? Their intentions are great. Their heart is great, okay? They're working hard and they're working for things that really matter. The things of God, is there any greater purpose in life than the gospel and whatever? But you talk to their wife, you talk to their kids, and they say, Daddy's never home because all he does is counsel, you know, people at the church, and he's trying to intervene in conflict and whatever. And you do that long enough, and all of a sudden you run out of reserve, and your tank's on empty, and you implode, and you're done. And your marriage is done, and your relationship with your kids is done, your ministry's done, and you either make some stupid moral decision and, you know, go binge drink or whatever it is, or you blow up and you can't do that long term. So Jethro realizes this as an older seasoned guy, and he says, Moses, I know where this is going. You feel noble. You're at the young ripe age of 80 right now, and you think you can do this forever. But I'm older than you, and you've just started your ministry career. Listen to me, okay? This is a bad idea. Okay, you're going to wear out and the people are going to wear out. So he says, Moses, this is what you need to do. Okay, I'm going to give you some counsel, and this is ultimately how you need to take care of that. Okay, pick up in 19 and let's keep going. Okay, here's the key, 21, keep going.
Moreover, look for a woman from all the people, men who fear God, who are trustworthy and keep and pride, and post men over the people as chiefs of thousands, of hundreds, of fifties, and of tens.
So what's the answer in 21? What are you to do, Moses? Delegate, get help. What type of people does he need around him? Find some trustworthy, wise, God-fearing people who aren't going to, you know, hate dishonest gain, that aren't going to be bribed, and then you're going to put them over the thousands, over the hundreds, and over the fifties. You're going to divide it, and you're going to have a person that sits over 1,000, and that person's going to sit over the people that sit over 100, who's going to sit over the people that sit over the fifties, and there's going to be a chain of command, and you're the top of it, and it's all going to flow out from there so that the people have a different type of structure, okay? These people will judge for you, basically what he says. Let them judge at 22 at all times, and let every major dispute they'll bring to you. But the minor ones, let them handle it. You've got gifted, talented people that can do these things. Let them do it. Let them exercise their gifts. Don't hoard the ministry to yourself, right? We hear constantly at the Well on staff, and I think it's such a great reminder, if we as the staff are doing the ministry, that something is wrong. If we are not equipping the saints for the work of the service, for the building up the body of Christ, then we are not doing, as pastors, as directors, as whatever, we're not doing our job. Because the fun of the ministry is to let you guys do it and to raise you guys up so that you can let other people do it. And that's the joy of ministry, okay? The pastor's job or the equipper's job is to raise up people to do the work, because the work is fun. The work is where you get to use your gifts, right? That's exciting. So Moses is directed by Jethro now to say, listen, you've got tons of godly people in your midst that want to do this, that are able to do this, and frankly, some of them are probably actually better than you. Raise them up and let them do it, okay? So that's his advice. Moses, go get a team and learn how to delegate, okay? Lest you don't kill yourself, okay? So he gets this advice, okay? He tells him at end of verse 22, it will be easier for you and they will bear the burden with you. This will be easier for you and it's ultimately going to be easier for the people. 23, if you do this thing that God commands you, then you will be able to endure and these people will also go to their place in peace. You won't kill yourself and you won't kill the people. Two good things, right? So notice 24, what does Moses do? Fantastic. So here's a guy who's got the most unique relationship with God as anyone's had in history, and he just listened to the advice of a non-Christian and said, you know what? That's exactly what I need to do. And he does it, right? You see why this guy's humble, right? Moses can do it basically whatever the heck he wants to, right? He's the guy, and God treats him as the guy. He's got a unique relationship. But he's smart enough to go, you know what, Jethro? You've been doing this a long time. That's great advice. I'm a rookie. What do I need to do? And he does it. Okay, so I like that. And I love that he's able to listen to folks outside of his kind of comfort zone. Okay, we'll see later on when he leaves Midian and they start traveling, he's going to ask his brother-in-law to come with him. He's like, listen, you know the land better than I do. Will you come with me and just be my guide? Will you just look at all the stuff and tell us where we need to go? Because I'm not an expert in, like, I'm not Bear Grylls, but you are. So come with me. He's a non-Christian. He says, but that's okay, because you're smart, right? Is it okay to get advice from non-Christians? Yeah, okay? I probably wouldn't get spiritual advice from them, but there are guys that know plumbing better than you do, right? There's people that know leadership better than you do, better than I do. Ask them. They have great advice, and you've got to weigh that and think through it. But here's a guy that goes, you know what, Moses? Or Jethro, you know what you're talking about here, okay? So good nugget. Yes, ma'am. It's a great concept, right? So, and you see that in the bigger the organization, the more time you can spend just trying to, you know, and those things happen. Like, we got a church staff of 70 some odd people, I guess. And I came here and we were four. I was a fourth hire. Now we're 70. It's crazy. But just the complexities, the interpersonal, I mean, it's normal. It happens. So, but you got to find a way to do it where it doesn't kill somebody, right? And we've about killed a couple people on staff because that was their job. You listen to everybody's complaints. Who wants to do that all day, right? I don't care how much harmonizer you have or, you know, the value of, like, it gets old, right? You want to shoot somebody at the end of the day. Like, quit whining. Get out of my office, right? And we've almost killed a couple of people doing that. It's necessary, but it's good. Can you guys think through a chapter in Acts where we saw that happen? It was a turning point for the apostles. You guys remember Acts chapter 6? Yes, they were overlooking the widows, and there was a complaint from the Hellenistic Jews and the Jewish Jews, and they came together and said, hey, listen, we feel something's not going right here. And the apostles realized, we're supposed to be teaching, and we're supposed to be praying and shepherding the people, and instead, we're setting tables, and we're having to deal with stuff that we shouldn't be dealing with. Not that it's minuscule, but there's other people that need to do this, and we need to do only what we can do, and we need to delegate the ministry. And there are godly people in our midst that want to do these things. Let them do it. So they do it, and they appoint seven people, and they say, great, deacons or whatever you call them, you go do this. You'll sit underneath us, and we'll attend to the things that God wants us to do, okay? Speaking of our proverb in Ecclesiastes, that's a great life lesson to figure out as well. What are the things that only you can do in your life? What is unique to you? Go do those things. That's a great just lens to think through your life and your ministry. What are the things that you are uniquely gifted at that only you can do? Spend your time doing those things and delegate the rest, right? There are very few things that I can do in my organization that no one else can do, but I need to do those things, okay? There are other things that our organization needs to get done that I could do that, frankly, there are people on our staff that are better than me at doing them. So they do them because they're better and they like them and I don't or do. And some of the things, you know what I mean? So it's just a good lens to think through, all right? So there's 18. Moses gets great advice, avoids a nervous breakdown, okay? So thankfully now we get to read about Moses all the way through Deuteronomy because he doesn't have a nervous breakdown and suck his thumb and lay in the fetal position now for the next 80 years of his life, so, or 40. Okay, so great advice from a great guy from there, all right? So 19, now we're gonna get introduced to the law, all right? So we are gonna see now 19:1, the third month after they had gone out. So they've been wandering now, or being led, I guess, through the wilderness for 3 months, okay? Verse 2, they came and set out from Rephidim. They came to the wilderness of Sinai, encamped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain, okay? 19:2, they are going to be camped in front of the mountain from 19:2 until Numbers chapter 10. They are not going to move, okay? So they just set up shop, okay? Exodus 19:2, they are not going to move until Numbers chapter 10, okay? And this is going to be a one-year period, okay? So what we're going to read from here all the way to Numbers 10 is going to occur over a one-year period, okay? You know, Exodus chapter 1, we got 400 years of history, like, in one chapter, and now we're going to get multiple books of the Bible that cover 1 year. You know, where is it? Numbers, it gives us all the details of the journey. I haven't ever mapped it out, but yeah. I mean, they're going various different places. And yeah, more than likely, they were probably in, like, I've seen that before, right? Something of that nature. So
they just can't, like, I mean, like, this just sounds really bad. So they can't just, like, walk out?
They could. It's that simple. I mean, it's like, there it is. It's not like, where do we go? Where is this place? They're not wandering. They're not lost. God just said, no, you're not allowed to go in. I will not permit it. So they're going to walk up to, at one point, Kadesh Barnea, which is on the south of the land. That's where the spies go. And it's literally right there. It's right in front of you. And they could have seen that from where they camped. But God says, nope, I'm not permitting you to go in. So it's a misnomer that they're wandering. Wandering sounds like lost. They're not lost. God just says, you're not allowed to go in. Yep, so they would follow wherever God goes, and it may sit there like for here, for they're going to be literally at 11 months in the same spot, and then one day they wake up and the cloud moves. Like, okay, pack up. The cloud's going to wherever. Follow it, and that's where we're camping, wherever it stops. So it's bizarre, and you don't know if, man, are we going to sleep here a night, or are we going to sleep here 365 nights? I don't know. Just get up, get your coffee, grab your manna, and figure out what's going on today. And if Moses blows the horn and says, it's time to go, it's time to go. That was their life for 40 years, okay? And the reason they don't get to go in is because they are disobedient and obstinate people that don't believe God. So God says, I'm going to kill all of you. You're going to die in the wilderness. Your sons and your daughters, who aren't disobedient and obstinate and are believers, they get to go in. And we're going to teach them exactly what the wilderness had to teach you, and that's why you have to stay here so long. So this is God's schoolhouse. This is where he teaches them. So take everything else away. There's no distractions. Just think about the lessons you've learned on mission trips, right? When you're out of your comfort zone, you don't know what you're going to eat. You don't know where your next meal's coming from. Everything's a mystery. Boy, you cling to God real hard in those moments, right? It's just a different environment. That's where they are for 40 years. Well, because Moses is the key to everything. They understand that. So, like, you don't follow Moses, you're going to die. So there is no food, there is no water. So like it or not, this is the situation. Yeah. So, okay. So 19, we're going to start with the law. Okay, here comes the Ten Commandments. This is the beginning of the law. Okay. So they're about to enter into kind of a covenant agreement. Okay, we're going to see that language used again between them and God. And this is a different type of covenant. Okay, this isn't a I promise to do regardless from God. This is a if you, then I. If you will obey these things, you're going to get blessed. If you disobey these things, then you're going to get cursed. So it's a you choose. Okay, it's a choose your own adventure book. Right? Here are the rules. Okay, you can turn to whatever page you want to. Okay, one's good, one's bad. Okay, one's blessing, the other one's hands on the chalkboard. It's your choice, Israel. Okay, but he does promise them some things regardless of their behavior. Okay, which is important. Okay, so they're in now verse 2, the foot of Mount Sinai. Okay, Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai, same place. Again, modern day, probably Saudi Arabia at the bottom of the Sinai Peninsula somewhere. They're in there, out in the wilderness, middle of nowhere. Okay, verse 3, Moses went up to God. The Lord called him from the mountain and said, thus you shall tell the house of Jacob, that's Israel. Verse 4, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Okay, so really cool picture of how God talks about how he cares for them as a mother eagle would her young. Okay, which is kind of fascinating because I'm told that the way a mother eagle gets her kids to fly, or birds to fly, is pushes them out of the nest. And they figure it out on the way down, and then that mother eagle will catch them before they hit the ground. Figure it out, right? That's, wow, but it's part of the picture, right? So, hey, I'm going to put you in a place that you want to be in, and that's how you're going to learn. So it's loving, but boy, it ain't always easy, right? So he says, I have borne you like a mother eagle. I brought you to myself. Verse 5, now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among the peoples, for all the earth is mine. Anybody got a different translation for my own possession in verse 5? Yeah. It literally means special treasure. It's like his pet name for Israel. Okay, it's you'll be my sweetheart. It's like what you call your wife, right? Or what I would call my wife. Some of you not so much. Later. You call your wife that, okay? So he's saying, I'm endeared to you. You're special to me. He calls them in Deuteronomy, my little Jeshurun, which means my little upright one. It's like his pet name for Israel. It's funny, right? But it's enduring. Did you like that? Ben, that's your new nickname, Jeshurun. How do you like that? So I don't know what just happened. Anyway, so there you go. So he has obviously the special relationship with them, and he says, hey, if you'll obey me, I will take care of you like this, okay? Verse 6, this is the key. Watch what they will become.
You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel.
All right, what does it mean that you shall be, speaking to Israel, all of Israel, a kingdom of priests, a holy nation? What is the role of the priest in Israel? God? Others? Here you go. So the role of Israel in the world is to do what? God? Others? Let me introduce you to God. That's what I want you to be. I stuck you in the navel of the world. Anybody that goes anywhere has to go through Israel. So you are going to introduce people to me. You're a kingdom of priests. Okay? What did Peter say about us in the New Testament about this concept? What are we called by Peter? The priesthood of believers. That's our job as Christians. We introduce people to God by our behaviors, by our beliefs, by our actions. Okay, that's our role. Okay, so fascinating concept. And he says, by your obedience, you're going to do this. When you follow me, people will see that. Okay, so that's the idea. Verse 7, Moses came and called all the elders of the people. Verse 8, people said, hey, all that the Lord has spoken to us, we will do. This sounds awesome, Moses. We really like that, okay? As long as you feed us and clothe us and I have my lazy boy and my big screen TV, we will definitely obey you, okay? And have someone rub my feet at night. That's kind of their attitude. When it's good, they're like, super. And when it's bad, they're like, where's Moses and where's my shotgun? Okay, so that's kind of their attitude, all right? Couple things to note just regarding the law as we move forward. They're about to get, again, the Ten Commandments that we'll look at. And then they're going to get 613 other commandments from God, okay? It's a long list, all right? So basically, from here all the way through Leviticus and parts of Deuteronomy, we're going to get the full extent of the law. We will not read them all, so be encouraged. But they get a bunch, okay? 613 do's and don't do's, okay? For Israel, part of the law was to do a couple things. It really has a multifaceted purpose. One was to expose sin, okay? Paul talks about in Romans 7 the idea that until the law came, he wasn't aware of what coveting was. Until the law said, do not covenant, or covet. It says, this is the standard, and you need to obey it. So it teaches Israel about sin. It also is going to protect Israel. God's going to give dietary laws. He's going to give hygienic laws. Don't eat this because it's filthy. Clean your house, right? Don't live in mold or whatever. It's going to protect Israel from themselves and from other things. So it's going to help them in that regard. Ultimately, it's going to point the people to Christ. Okay. Immediately after God gives the law, what does he provide? Are they to obey the law all the time? Does God know, oh yeah, I'm going to give you 613 commandments and you guys are going to obey them all? What does he give them? Here's the sacrificial system right on the heels of it. So what is God assuming about the law? You're going to break it. You're people. You're not me. You're going to goof up. The law was not given for them to be perfect. The law was given to say, this is the standard and it's unobtainable. You have to sacrifice when you break the law. But there is one that will come that can keep the law. Every jot, every tittle, every piece of the law this person can do. So it's pointing to one ultimately in the future that can, where they realize they can't. So God never expected them to be perfect. He expected them to obey. And when they didn't obey, to sacrifice, to confess, to say, Lord, I blew it again, and I'm sorry, and I'm repentant, and I want to move on. Okay? So that's the process. Okay? And it also taught, I think, in a sense, about true righteousness. You guys will learn kind of the idea of antinomianism, okay, in Romans chapter 6 as PJ takes you guys there. Just because you're a covenant people with God doesn't give you a get-out-of-jail-free card to do whatever you want to, okay? It's not hell insurance, right? It's not live crazy because I'm a Christian. It's like, no, because I love God, I obey God. I don't love God and say that I believe these things and live like, you know, a moral lunatic just because I'm saved. Those don't fit, okay? So part of that was, man, if you love God, then you keep his word. And you keep his word because you love. That's the package, okay? So just to give you guys an idea of where it's going, all right? So that's the idea, okay? Chapter 19, more of this is about Moses kind of going up and down the mountain. We're going to hear lots of this in the future. God's going to say, hey, this situation is pretty serious. So I want you guys just to note of a couple things. Verse 12 of chapter 19, God says to Moses, you're going to set bounds for the people all around. It says, beware that you do not go up the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. So Moses, when you go up the hill and we intervene, you make sure the people realize this is a really big deal and you're about to meet me. If they even step foot on the mountain, they're going to die. Okay, so this is a holy, significant experience. Okay, Moses goes down and tells the people, don't do these things. That's a bad idea. Verse 15, be ready for the third day. Do not go near a woman. He says, listen, you guys need to abstain from sexual relationships with your spouse for 3 days. You need to prepare and worship and get your minds right for 3 days before Moses goes up the hill to get the Ten Commandments, okay? He's just saying, listen, you need to be in the right place spiritually to interact with me, okay? So he kind of calls them to a high standard and helps them understand, okay? Verse 16, on the third day, it was morning, there was thunder and lightning flashes, a thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled, okay? This is the people in the presence now of God. It's a big deal. Lightning, thunder, right? This is like the burning stove that we read about in Genesis. It's the best picture that we can get of a holy God coming to interact now with the people that are sinful. They tremble. They fear God because this is a really big deal, okay? Verse 18, you even see those illustrations again. The Lord descended in fire, smoke of a furnace. The whole mountain quaked violently. 19, sound of thunder, lightning. He sends now Moses down again and says, hey, rewarn the people. He goes up and down the hill numerous times to say, hey, just in case I wasn't clear the first time, don't come up here, okay? Goes back up. God says, no, go down again and tell him again, right? So it's just a significant deal, all right? Verse 24 even says, hey, when you come up, Aaron and some of the priests are going to be able to go to a certain point with you, but after that, You make sure that they know this is you and me, and not even the priest can do what you can do. So everyone kind of has a certain role and rules and restrictions about them as they go meet God now for the first time in a while. Okay? So chapter 20, here come the Ten Commandments, right? These are the big ten. So this is what God now delivers to them. So let's pick up 20 verse 1 and read that. All right, so there's your first one. What's the first commandment? No gods, okay? I'm it. I am one, okay? That is part of the Shema that we're going to memorize in Hebrew. The Lord your God is one. He is Ichad, okay? He is one, and you will worship him as one, okay? God is not down with being one among many, okay? So you have no other gods before me. So he's now modeling for them. This is your religious life, okay? This is how you're going to live, okay? Keep going, verse 4. Okay, so no idols, right? Why would he tell them that? Think all the way back to Abraham. What is the tendency of every false religion? Make something, bow down to it, call it God. That's what they did, okay? So he says, don't make anything. Don't make some figurine of me. I don't want a G.I. Joe that you put on your mantle and that you worship and call that God. I am God, so don't make an idol, okay? So no syncretism. You're not going to pick up habits from the non-Christians around you and worship me in a way that they worship me. That is not how I'm to be worshipped, okay? Verse 5, keep going. This is the kind of the rest of verse 4.
You shall not bow down on them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God.
What does that mean, that he's a jealous God? He wants our attention, and he wants all of our affection, okay? I am a jealous husband. I will share Michelle with no one. Okay, I am jealous for her and of her. I want all of her. God says, I am jealous of you and your worship of me. I want all of you. I'm not going to share you with things on your mantle that are as important as I am. It's either all of me or none of me, but there is no some of me and some of something else. Okay, so different things today stick for us, but that's the idea. Okay, he is one among one. He's not one among our cars and the stuff and whatever other idols that we tend to worship. God says, that's I, me, or me alone, okay? Let's see. Go down to verse 7. Here comes the third commandment.
You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold you guiltless.
Okay. That isn't necessarily what we think when people drop the word or whatever. That's not taking the Lord's name in vain. It's to make a promise in the name of God and then not fulfill it. You don't use God's name lightly. You esteem him. So don't say, man, I'm going to do this and then not do it, or to somehow demean his character by your actions and promising something in his name or what have you. Okay, so don't. You're going to protect God. You're going to make sure that you handle yourself appropriately. Okay, verse 8, number 4. Okay, when's the Sabbath in Israel? What day of the week?
Friday.
Saturday, okay? Starts Friday night, okay? But Saturday is kind of the Sabbath, okay? Sunday, the new week starts over. So Sabbath is Saturday. That's when they rest, okay? That's literally what Sabbath means, by the way, is to rest, okay? 6 days you shall do no labor, or 6 days you shall labor, and then you're going to rest on the seventh, okay? That's a Sabbath. Verse 10, no work, not your son or your daughter, not your male or female servant. Nobody does work on the Sabbath, okay? Because, verse 11, here's why. Okay, so that's why. I'm the pattern, okay? I worked six, I rested one, I wasn't tired, but I needed to stop and show you guys an example of work and rest, reflect, okay? Live life, enjoy, right? And in Israel, they do that really well, okay? Verse 12, here comes now commandment 5.
Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you.
Okay, what does that mean to honor your father and mother? What is he setting up now? What are you supposed to do as a younger person? Respect your elders and respect authority. said, respect your parents, okay? There is literally a law that says if you curse your mother and father, you can be stoned to death. Can you imagine? Like going to the mall and seeing some kid like backtalk his mom, and that can be grounds for stoning? That was Israel, okay? You respect your parents. Whether you like what they say or not, they are your authority, okay? So we'll read some of these laws and you go, boy, our society would look completely different if people would just look at those and go, you know what? That's actually a really good idea. It's fascinating, okay? We'll look at some of them this morning, okay? Honor your father and mother, okay? Verse 13, you shall not murder. You will value life, okay? You're not going to take other people's lives. That's not appropriate, okay? Now, there will be punishment for people that do, and it's an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. We're going to see that same theme, okay? So if someone takes someone's life, that person's life has the right to be taken, okay? That's how God sets it up, but he is not a fan of murder, obviously, okay? Verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. So you need to honor another man's wife. You need to honor your wife or husband, for that matter. You don't commit adultery. Verse 15, you shall not steal. Okay, so you're going to honor property. That's the eighth commandment. Honor what is yours and what is somebody else's. Verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Okay, you need to have honesty, integrity. Okay, you need to handle your tongue appropriately. Okay, and the last one, verse 17, you shall not covet. Okay, you're going to be content. Okay, other people are going to have stuff you don't have. So what? Enjoy what you got, okay? Appreciate it and quit looking around for stuff that you don't have, okay? So that's the idea, all right? 18, people saw this, stood at a distance. They trembled again in verse 18, and God now kind of gives them this law. Verse 22, the Lord said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven, okay? So this is God's now commandment to them, and they take kind of these first 10 things as a in a summary, basically, of all the law that's coming. This Ten Commandments is like your cliff notes of the whole law, okay? You get the details if you want to read the rest, but this for them was this was the cliff notes version of everything God wanted them to do, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So there's 19. There are your Ten Commandments, all right? Or 20, rather, all right? Make sense? Fabulous. Mm-hmm. We will get there. Yep, that's going to come in the end of the book of Exodus. Yep, 34. Yeah. Jeez, he's coming. All right, 21. Okay, here's some more laws. All right, this is kind of a random assortment of laws. This one is one of my favorites, to be honest with you. This is really cool, and you'll see why here in a second where this language gets picked up in the New Testament. 21:1, read this. All right, so if you buy a Hebrew slave, okay, slavery was a part of the Hebrew culture, again, not slavery like we think of it, but if you were an indentured servant, okay, if you had to give yourself to another in order to pay bills and whatever, God says, listen, there's a way that you're going to treat these people. You may purchase them. They are yours to be your butler, your maid, for whatever, for 6 years. At the end of 6 years, they're to go free, okay? You know, if you got Mike and he came in and he was single, Mike leaves single. If he got married while he was in your house, then Mike and Michelle both get to leave free, okay? They get to start a new life, okay? Now, I want you to notice just from the context how much different their system is than from ours, okay? Verse 5, read that. So that's... He's saying, this could happen. Man, I love it here. I want to stay underneath your authority, okay? Not as a slave, but as a servant of my own free will. I don't want to leave, okay? There's not a whole lot of people that said that in our slavery system, right? So this is very clearly different. I love you. You've taken good care of me, as the Bible said that you should. I want to stay here with my wife and with potentially my kids. That could happen. This is how this is to happen, okay? So if he says, I don't want to go out as a free man, verse 6, keep going. So the master would take that slave outside by the door, okay? he would take an ice pick and stick it his ear on the door jamb, and he would run an ice pick through his ear, okay? And it's a very physical way of saying you are permanently indebted to this house. You are saying, underneath your own free will, that you don't want to leave, okay? You are no longer a slave, you're a bondservant, okay? You are choosing to serve a master, not because you have to, but because you want to. Very different motivation, okay? So it was this, literally, audio-visual of them to say, yeah, I am that committed to you, okay? You can run an ice pick through my ear, and I am now a servant of this household, okay? Where does that language get picked up in the New Testament? Paul, a bond servant of Christ. What did Paul have in mind when he said those words? I would bet he had Exodus 21 in mind. I'm not a slave. I don't follow God because God makes me. I'm a freed slave, but I serve my master because I love him, right? That's the picture, and that's the words that Paul uses. And I think to any Hebrew that would have heard that, they would have went, got it. I understand what Paul's saying, okay? He doesn't have to, he wants to, and he willingly submits himself to his master, okay? So it's a neat picture that gets picked up in the New Testament, okay? So that's the idea. So again, if you have a slave in Israel, you treat them right. You take care of them. If they want to stay with you, then they can, but they don't have to, okay? Interesting, 7 and following talks about what happens if kids have slaves and male and female servants, and so let's kind of read through and look at it. Verse 7, pick up there. Yes, I'm stop right there. So if a man has to sell his daughter into slavery for whatever reason, the master has to take care of her. He doesn't have to let her go as he would a male slave, but he also can't just sell her. He is required to care for her for basically the remainder of his life, okay? If he designates her for his son, meaning you are now going to be my son's wife, okay, he must deal according to the custom of the daughters, meaning you treat her as if she was basically a non-slave, with all the rights of a non-slave. You take care of her, okay? This system would have been in effect to protect women in that society. You treat them with esteem, okay? If he takes to himself another woman, he may not reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights, okay? If this guy, this son, marries this slave daughter, and then decides to take another wife for himself, okay, which isn't God's heart, but he's going to allow for it throughout the law, what does he say about that first wife? What can you not do? You can't reduce her food, her clothing, or her conjugal rights. I mean, you need to take care of her. You raise up for her a family, okay? You make sure that you don't favor another woman and say, I'm not going to have any kids with you. I'm only going to have kids with you. He said, no, that's not appropriate. This is not some sex slave. This isn't some guy with a harem full of women. This isn't some perverted deal that kind of we see multiple wives as. He says, no. Your job is to take care of them, okay? So that's the picture in Israel. When you see this multiple wife concept throughout the Old Testament, is always a way to say, this woman is to be esteemed and valued, and the reason that you're bringing her in is to take care of her, to raise up a family, to make sure that she doesn't lose her namesake, okay? It's not a, you know, Lamech, I have 7 wives, and the heck with you, God. That's not the attitude under which God says that's okay, all right? The movement is always Adam and Eve, one man, one woman for life. And we see that again reiterated in the New Testament. That is God's heart. He allows for things that are not necessarily his favorite, but the angle is always to protect the rights of women, okay? And again, in this society, women were far more highly esteemed than in other cultures at that same time. Does that make sense? So you talk about like women's lib. God was women's lib way before there was women's lib, okay, in a healthy, right way. But he supported women's rights long before, he was on the cutting edge of that, if you will, long before that, okay? Now, I wouldn't compare that to today. He's not a big women's lib fan, I don't think. But God liked women in a right, healthy way, okay? That didn't come out to me, I meant to say it. So, moving on. Capital punishment, chapter 21, verse 12. Read that. Yes.
Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death.
All right, easy enough. You kill somebody, you're going to get killed. All right? However, verse 13.
But if you did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hands, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee.
What does that mean? If he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand. Yeah. It's manslaughter, not first-degree murder, okay? If something happened and the circumstances went south and you ran over a dude with your ox by accident and you killed him, right? While you're out farming and you're, whatever, okay? It wasn't premeditated. He says, I will provide for you a place where you may flee. Any idea of where that place is or places are? No. There are six of them. Three on each side of the Jordan. They're called cities of refuge, okay? And God says, I will set up three cities on each side of the Jordan, so six total, where the Levites live, okay? God gives them cities. He doesn't give them a land. He gives them 48 Levitical cities. Six of those are called cities of refuge. And you basically are in house arrest, okay? But your house isn't a house, it's a city. So if you killed somebody, you can go stay there, and the person who had the right to take your life cannot take it until the high priest dies, and then it's ollie, ollie, oxen free. Everyone comes out of the city, and you're fair game, okay? So that's the reset button. But they said, hey, there's punishment. You have to take responsibility for your actions, but I'm not going to take your life, so you're confined to a city, and no one can kill you, okay? That's the idea. And we'll see a cool picture of that, an unfortunately cool picture of that in the story of Saul and Solomon and Samuel and Saul later on in, as we journey through, okay? So, verse 14, keep going.
But if a man willfully attacks another to kill him by cunning, you shall take him from my altar that he may die.
So he says, hey, if this is premeditated and you were cunning or crafty, as mine says, I don't care if he's worshiping me in the tabernacle, you take him off the altar and you kill him, okay? So he's like, there is no get out of jail free card. I don't care if you're in the midst of worship. You pull him out of church, for all I care, and you take him out back and you whoop him and kill him, okay? That's basically the idea. You don't get, just because you're feigning, religious obedience doesn't mean that you get to get out of having to pay the consequences, okay? He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. How you like that? Verse 17, he who curses his father or mother shall surely be put to death. You think child rearing would look a little bit different if kids knew that today? Now, there's no evidence of this ever happening. There's nowhere in the scriptures where some kid was stoned to death because he told his parents where, they could go. But the idea is, listen, if you're a Hebrew kid, you respect authority. That was just ingrained into them. And you don't have the right to, I don't like that. And I don't want to go to my room or, I want that toy and not be respectful. Okay? That's the idea. How about 18? This is fantastic. So verse 18, there's two guys, they get in a bar fight, okay? And one guy smacks another. He doesn't die, but he ends up in the ER. What does that guy have to do? Guess who's paying my ER bill? You are. You're taking responsibility, imagine this, for your actions. You have to take care of him. If he doesn't die, there's no punishment, but you're writing the check. Until when? 19, end of 19. You're doing his physical therapy, you're paying his ER bill, you are taking care of what you're supposed to take care of, okay? Chapter 20 is all about taking personal responsibility. It's on you. It's not somebody else's fault. If you hit a guy, great. You're putting him in a cast, you're putting him in whatever he needs to do to get healed, you're paying his worker's comp because he was out of work now, it's on you. So you want to smack a guy at a bar? Fantastic. Here are the consequences to that, okay? Different perspective on life. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. God's not a fan, right? Yeah. No, sorry, I skipped it. You're right. Absolutely. Yep. So that'd be a good verse to hang on that doorknob. Okay. Okay. So I like that. 18 and 19. This is, what? Sorry. Yeah, my bad. There you go. That's your verse for those of you that are God's entwining your heart to human trafficking. That's a great reminder. Okay. Verse 20, if a man strikes a male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. Okay. Verse 22, this is interesting. Okay, read this. Okay, so the idea is two guys get in a fight, you injure a pregnant woman, and her baby comes out. The idea is alive. My version says miscarry, but that's not, I think, what it actually means. So the baby comes out alive, and there's no harm done to mom or baby. Okay? Then what happens?
The one who injured shall surely be fined.
Okay, so there's a fine, and the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay the judges and let the judges decide. However, verse 23. So if you get in a fight and you accidentally hit a pregnant woman and that woman miscarries so that there is harm to her child, what happens? That guy dies. Where does life begin according to God? In the womb, right? Life for life. Unborn life to life? Absolutely. But I didn't mean to do it. I just got in a bar fight and that guy pushed me and I hit that woman. Sorry. It's called personal responsibility, okay? You shouldn't have been in that situation. Handle yourself better, okay? So, fantastic, okay? How about verse 28? This is fantastic.
When an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall be stoned, and its flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall not be liable.
Okay, so you've got an ox on your property, and it gores somebody, okay? Happens, okay? That ox is to die. Okay, it's going to pay for the life of that person that that now dies. And what else can you not do with that ox? You don't get the benefits of that. You don't get to eat off that ox because it gored someone. There is no upside. You put that ox to death and you burn it. Okay. However, verse 29. Wow. So you've got an ox that's gored someone in the past, and you as the owner don't take personal responsibility for it, and it gores somebody else again, then what? Ox dies and you die. Wow. Hey, I got a pit bull. It's not, you know, whatever. Sorry, it bit you. That's just kind of what they do. Really? What would happen today or back then? Great. We'll kill the dog and we'll kill the owner. Problem solved. Okay? It sounds harsh, but the idea is God saying, listen, take personal responsibility. Are you responsible for just you? No. You're responsible for your land, your animals, your home, everything around you that is yours, you have to be responsible for. And if you can't, then you shouldn't have it. It's that easy. So your ox kills somebody, that's your responsibility. You don't blame the ox, right? Just a different system. So, and again, there's a whole lot of this that you look at God and go, boy, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, when people can't point the finger and blame someone else or blame the system, when they have to own their mistakes and there's consequences for them. I mean, how many ox gorings do you think you had to see where an owner dies where you go, you know what? I'm going to make sure I build a really good fence and I'm going to make sure that I take care of my land. You only need to see one or two, right? And you go, got it. Okay. It's not worth my life, and I'm going to take responsibility, right? So that's the idea. Verse 32, we've mentioned this before, but it's, again, just an interesting connection to the New Testament. Okay, so 30 shekels of silver was what a dead ox was valued at, okay? Matthew 26:15 is the same price that Jesus was sold for at the hands of Judas, 30 pieces of silver, okay? So that's where, that's what Judas paid for the rights to give up Jesus, okay? So, Again, all about personal responsibility. 33, if a man opens a pit, digs a pit, and forgets to cover it, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution. He shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. Okay? You're out working in the field, and you forget to cover up the hole that you dug, and someone dies as a result of it. It's not the hole's fault. It's your fault. It's your responsibility. Okay? So, fascinating, again, just how God elevates that idea. Amazing, by the way, that this is where the laws start, okay? Honor me, don't covet, don't murder, don't steal. And then the first thing God talks about is personal responsibility, okay? Beginning of the law, all right? 22, this is kind of cool, New Testament connotations here. 22:1. Okay, so if you steal one, okay, what do you have to repay? Four or five oxen, okay? You guys remember the story in the New Testament, Zacchaeus, when he realized his own sin, was confronted with Jesus, and he went to repay people, what did he repay them? Do you remember? It was four or five times the amount that he had wrongfully taken from them as a tax collector, okay? Where did he get that concept? The law. That's what the law said to do, okay? You steal 20, you pay back a hundo, okay? You think you're going to be less inclined to steal? Yeah, because it's not just I'll pay back 20 and call it good, or we'll slap your hand. It's like, no, okay, you rob a guy 20 bucks, you now owe him a Benjamin, okay? Okay, that hurts a little bit more. That's a little more sting, right? Not going to do it. So that's the idea. Verse 2, this is a great Texas law. Somebody breaks into your house and you shoot him, what happens? Fine, okay? There is a Texas law, I've never actually read it, so I am told that there is a Texas law. If you shoot a dude breaking into your house and he falls inside your home, you're good. He falls outside your home and you can be punished. So the moral of the story is after you shoot him, you drag him into your house, okay? But that's the determination between whether he was actually breaking in or not breaking in, okay? So, anyway, so just wait a little bit longer before you pop them, okay? But that's the idea, okay? You're going to break into my home. I mean, have you heard of these lawsuits where people sue people that harmed them while they were breaking into their home? You're like, are you kidding me, right? It's amazing. Well, you harmed me while I was trying to come in and steal your DVD player. Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what I did. Anyway, amazing to me. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of the Bible and the things that it sets up. So, there you go, okay? Carry a gun, shoot them if they're breaking in your home. So, yeah, okay? Verse 3, keep going.
But if the sun has risen on him, there shall be blood guilt for him. He shall surely pay. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft.
So, that guy's going to make restitution one way or the other, okay? Verse 5, how about irresponsibility? More of this. You got a broken down fence and your beast wanders next door because you got a property that's not taken care of and the grass really is greener on the other side and he goes and eats the neighbor's grass, you're responsible for what that beast ate because you're stealing from your neighbor, okay? If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes so that stacked grain or standing grain in verse 6, or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution, right? Because you didn't take care of your stuff. Did you start the fire? No. But was it your negligence on your property that caused the fire to be started? Yes. Guess what? You got to pay for it. Absolutely, right? And he's going to tell them as much that, you know, they're coming into the land. Like, God allowed them the chance to come into the land. They're going to choose not to. So he's preparing them basically to go in full on knowing that how they're going to choose. The other piece of this, why would this be important when you got 1.2 million bodies trying to cohabit together in the wilderness? What is he saying to them about, why would this apply now?
Tempers are probably flaring, and people might be interested, be like, hey, he's got more mana than I do, and I'm hungry.
Yeah. Don't steal. Treat your neighbor with respect. Don't covet what he has. Live in peace with, so he's teaching them how to live together in community in a sense as well, okay? So that's the idea. You guys getting a feel for the law and just kind of what God's putting out for them, okay? How about 22:16? How about immorality?
If a man seduces a virgin, he shall give the bride to Christ.
So if you sleep with a virgin as a male, what just happened? You married her. And what else? You just wrote her dad a check. What do you think that dad, the dad now gets to determine the value of that daughter? How do you think he's going to price her? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. No. Add a zero. In fact, no, add two. Okay? If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, like, no, you're not marrying my daughter. You're a chump. Now, that was the normal inclination to protect a woman would say, okay, you slept with her. You violated her. You have made her less valuable in the eyes of other suitors. You're going to marry her. And according to the verses that we just read, how did you have to treat her? With respect, take care of her, raise up a family, provide her food and clothing, and you will care for her as her father would, right? That is your job. But if her dad says, no, you're a chump, I'm not allowing you to marry her, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins, okay? So the dad, again, I'll set whatever price I want to, and you're going to pay it, okay? So it's the dad's obligation, okay? So, again, in Israel, what is sex equal? Marriage, okay? Eyes of God, sex equals marriage, okay? So, yeah, thank goodness for grace, okay? Says my life, okay? 18, how about this?
You shall not permit a sorceress to live.
Okay, so God's not a big fan of witches and witchcraft, okay? Here's an interesting law that God felt necessary to put in. Verse 19.
Whoever lies with an animal shall be put to death.
There you go. It's in the law, okay? Right? Yeah, so there you go. It's... God thought of everything, right? So there it is, okay? Yeah. Yeah. So just like, hey, these are right relationships. These aren't. Now, why would the other reason be? Not to be graphic. What do they sing around them with all the pagan peoples? This would not be odd, okay? And you're going to see at one of the sites we go, part of their worship would have included this. Okay? Yeah, it was exactly right. Okay? It was not odd for pagan worship services to be very sexual in nature. Okay? We'll leave it at that. But they were gross misunderstandings of what God had intended in sexuality. Okay? So there would have been a very carnal appeal to Israel to want to participate in their worship services, not because they were just worshiping some G.I. Joe action figure, but because of what else happened in those worship arenas, okay? You guys are going to read all about that in the spring, okay, when we get into more of our Israel stuff. But there was a lot going on that God said, yeah, you talk about what I set up, and the opposite of that is just a perversion of what I said was right. They pervert it as far as they can pervert it, okay? So God has to set up laws like this to say, by the way, that's not okay. All right, so verse 21, this is kind of cool.
You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt.
So you meet a stranger who doesn't look like you, doesn't talk like you. How do you treat them? With respect, right? You take care of them, okay? Why? Because you were strangers. You remember what it like to feel... You felt oppressed. You felt looked down upon because of your God or your nation or the tongue that you spoke in or the color of your skin. God says, uh-uh, we don't do that here. There is no racism with me. You treat people of different socioeconomic statuses the same. You treat people the same, different skin color, the same. That is not going to fly, okay? Just fascinating, he says, because you know exactly what that felt like, okay? Verse 22, you shall not afflict the orphan or the widow. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will hear his cry. So even the least and the last in the land, you will not treat them with any differing status. And if they cry out to me, I will hear them. Okay, because God cares about, again, the widow and the orphan. And we see that, again, reminded to us in the New Testament. Okay, 25, if you lend money to my people, okay, you got a buddy who's a Jew who's broke and needs money. Okay, what are you to do with them? Verse 25, read that.
If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to him, and you shall not exact interest from him.
How about that? Okay. Jeremy needs 20 bucks. I give him 20 bucks. He doesn't have to pay me back 25. He pays me 20 because he's my brother. Okay, I don't charge him interest. That's not right. Okay, so you don't charge your own people that way. What if he has nothing to give you? What if he gives you his cloak, his coat, his one coat to say, this is, I promise I'll pay you back, 26, okay? You are to return it to him before the sun sets. Before it gets cold, you give it back to him. Whether he's paid you back or not, you don't withhold his basic necessities from him, okay? So God just says, listen, you treat your own people right. You guys remember the book of Nehemiah and the thing that ticked him off more than just about anything else in the book? He comes to the leaders and he says, you are exacting usury from the people. You leaders are lending out money, and in return, you're charging interest. You're taking people's daughters and sons as slaves. And Nehemiah says, we are not doing that. And he returns to the law and says, that is not okay. And he makes them all give it back and return it. And because Nehemiah had lived above board and said, I'm not doing any of this, you're not going to do any of it either, they all turn around and basically say, we will do what you've asked, okay? So God says, that's not cool, okay? 28, here's a convicting one. Read that. What does that mean? You shall not curse a ruler of your people. Respect authority, respect our president. Did you vote for him? It doesn't matter. Do you like him? It doesn't matter. God says, I put him in office. I'm in charge of all government. You will treat him with respect, okay? Think about that. That's convicting, you know? There's a lot of things that we may not like, and there's a way to appropriately communicate that, and there's a way to attack somebody in their character and what have you in a way that's dishonoring to God. God says, that's not cool. And there's no clause there. There's no if this or if he asked you to do that or what have you, okay? So until we are asked to sin by our government, we are to respect that authority and come underneath it knowing that it's ultimately God's authority, not our own, okay? So, convicting. So, all right. 23, he kind of ramps it up a little bit, okay? Look at verse 4. How are you to treat your enemy, people you don't like so much? 23:4. Really? So you got some guy that you guys don't agree on anything. You hate this guy. He's your enemy. And you see his ox wandering outside of his property. What are you supposed to do? Go get it. Be personally inconvenienced. Go get his ox. Stop whatever you're doing and return it to your neighbor, even though he's your enemy. Like, man, God doesn't give you a whole lot of slack here, does he? You're going to treat people the right way. How about verse 5? Keep going. So you see a donkey that's been overloaded and literally is lying down under its load and can no longer get up. What do you have to do to that donkey? You have to remove the load from the donkey and free the donkey from its stupid owner that overloaded it, right? That's your job, right? Personal inconvenience. Yeah, it's a pain. I don't want to do it. Well, guess what? The law says you don't have that right not to, okay? Verse 6, you shall not pervert the justice due to a needy brother in his dispute. You're going to take care of those that are in need. Again, just interesting laws, right, that elevate the idea of you're going to take care of other people. Because verse 9, you shall not oppress a stranger, since you yourselves know the feelings of a stranger, for you also were strangers in the land of Egypt. You were oppressed. It was miserable. You are not going to oppress other people. Okay, that's the idea. All right. How about your land? Your land. Okay. Verse 11. Actually, start in verse 10, 23:10.
6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard.
So 6 years, you guys can pick the produce of your land, reap whatever you sow. The seventh year, however, what happens? You return it. You leave it alone. And who's it for? It's a welfare system. Hey, anybody that has need, there's my field. Take anything you want. And when you're done eating, my grapes, my oranges, my whatever, bring in your beasts and let them eat. Feed your ox, feed your sheep, whatever they need, it's yours. Okay? What's the idea then? How does God provide for you? What does he have to do that 6 year? He's got to provide the year that you're in. He's got to provide for you in that year for the year after, the seventh year while you're not eating. And when you sow at the beginning of the eighth year, you got to have something to eat while everything's in the ground and growing. So in year six, God's going to provide for you for year six, year seven, and year eight in 1 year. How much trust did that take as a farmer? I mean, it's hard enough as a farmer to wait and see and pray for the rain and whatever. And God says, no, the 6 year, you're hands off, okay? You got to let me provide for you for 3 years, okay? And I'll do it. And everything in your field, it's going to somebody else, okay? So again, just really cool stuff, okay? Rest of chapter 23 is more about the feast and festival schedule that we've covered already. Verse 14, three times a year, you are to celebrate a feast to me. So again, you see on your chart, if you have that out, I kind of wrote in blue those three feasts with Passover, Pentecost, or weeks, or tabernacles that were the three that all males had to return to Jerusalem. They had to go home to the temple. Ultimately, that would be there. And they had to worship together. And you took a mandatory Sabbath and you hung out with your family and you celebrated God and all that he's done. Okay? You worship together in community, mandatory, minimum three times a year. Okay? Just a cool picture. He makes them stop and remember him. Okay? So, that's the 23. Okay? Verse 20, he says, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way. Okay? So not only are you going to have the fire and the cloud that represent me, you're going to have an angel that's going to lead you throughout the wilderness. Okay? As you encounter, verse 24, various other gods, you are not to worship their gods. You're not going to serve them. You're not going to do according to their deeds, but you're going to utterly overthrow them and break their sacred pillars. So anything that you come across that's not of me, you destroy it. There is no syncretism. You don't live with them, in covenant relationship. You don't make on the side agreements. You're going to remove everybody from the land. Okay, verse 29, he says, I will not drive them out before you in a single year. Okay, this isn't you enter the land and I'm going to expel everybody at the same time. Okay, verse 30, I will drive them out before you little by little. As you grow and as you plant and as you continue to obey, we're going to continue to drive the people out of the land. Okay, by the way, this is going to be Israel's biggest issue when they get into the land. Joshua comes in. They are strong at the beginning. He does his job. They begin to rid the people of the land like God says. Joshua dies, and then the book of Judges happens, and everybody goes, you know what? The Philistines are way over on the coast. Can't they just kind of live there? It's a pain. We don't want to mess with it. Let's just let them be. And that is what turns into the problems that we're dealing with today in the Gaza Strip and a two-nation state and all that stuff because Israel did not obey God fully when they entered the land. Okay, so God says, I'll do it, but you've got to work for it. Okay, this isn't like some magic spell that I'm going to cast and float all the people out of the land and remove them. He's like, you got to go to battle and you got to man up and you got to do it. Okay, verse 33, they shall not live in your land because they will make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. That's why you can't have them there. They worship other gods. I will not allow you to worship other gods. That's what's going to happen, okay? One day, your hearts will turn, so rid them, okay? So tomorrow, we will look at 25 and following, the tabernacle, okay? I'll walk you guys through that, provide you some handouts and some visuals on that that we didn't get to today, and show you kind of the tabernacle that God's going to have them make in this mobile place of worship. And then we will finish up the book of Exodus, all right? So, fabulous.